Right, ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to Torah Studies Live. This is our weekly exploration of the Torah portion. This week, we start a brand new book, Chumash Shemos, the book of Exodus, or Shemot, depending on your Havara preference, how you like to pronounce it. Either way, we begin the story of Egyptian slavery and the Exodus, which is one of the main themes of the book, the second book of the Torah. Now, let's talk about some themes for tonight. Tonight's major theme is going to be origins of nationhood. What makes us a nation, and what is the greatest challenge to our nation, to our peoplehood, to us as the Jewish people? So what is the greatest challenge that we face today? And what makes a nation a nation? What constitutes the essence of a nation? So in order to jump into this topic, we're going to go through some of the themes of the opening of the Torah portion. Please open up the Chumash to page 344 in your Gunnik edition, and you'll find the beginning of the book of Exodus, the beginning of Parashat Shemot. Again, page 344, 345. The Torah portion and the book, the second book of the Torah, begins with an account of the children of Israel, the Jewish people that came down to Egypt. First of all, you need to notice right away that the Jewish people are called what? B'nai Yisrael, which means? Children of Israel. Right? Are they a nation yet?
No.
Nope, they're not a nation. They're a family. Okay. Children of Israel, and the Torah enumerates the 12 tribes, and then it talks about the big fear, the great fear of the Egyptian Pharaoh. This is starting from verse number 8. All right, Yaakov, please begin verse number 8, 345, fourth paragraph down, where it says, a new king.
A new king arose over Egypt who did not know Yosef. He said to his people, look, the nation of Israel's descendants are more numerous and stronger than we are. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they increase. For if a war will occur, they will join our enemies, fight against us, and depart from the land.
So here we have another rationale for anti-Semitism. What is the stated rationale for the king of Egypt? Why we have to get rid of the Jews? What's going to happen? What's the fear?
They'll multiply,
too many. And what's going to happen if they become too many? They're going to take over. Right now, they're minority. They're the minority. What happens when they become the majority? Uh-oh. So they're afraid. This is at least a stated reason. They're afraid of the Jewish populace. And then what if they side? What if the Jewish people become so numerous and then they side with the enemy? Will be doomed, will be destroyed.
Why would they depart from the land?
And depart. For if a war will occur, they will join our enemies, fight against us, and depart from the land.
Stop working for us.
Either
so
stop. Well, yeah. But Allah min ha'aretz.
They were a workforce.
Even before they were a workforce, they were a blessing. Mm. It's interesting, though. You know, you're trying to have your cake and eat it too. You want to have the blessing, but also have them under your thumb. It's like a little contradictory. We love him, but we hate him. We can't handle them, but we want him. Yeah, they're going to destroy us, but let's keep him here. Right, it's a very paradoxical conversation. But then again, since when has anti-Semitism made any sense, you know, in general?
Doesn't
make any sense. I'm actually working on an anti-Semitism series that hopefully will launch soon, because I feel like this is becoming increasingly a problem. We see this in various instances and areas around the country right now and around the world. And it's unfortunately a very timely topic. But again, here we have probably one of the early stated instances of straight up Jew hatred and fear mongering.
Nobody does anything against the anti-Semitism.
Saying today or then?
Now. They don't.
Okay, so we're.
It can only increase when they do nothing.
Okay, so we got to take action.
We have to take action.
We have to get together.
Yeah.
And so again, please God, we as an educational institute Our focus is going to be on educating Jews as to what the problem is and what we can do to do it. And then after that, we all can do our part. Okay, let's continue. 347, please. Let's see how the decree takes shape.
Can I keep going?
Yeah, please.
So they appointed over them tax collectors to afflict them with their burdens. And the Jewish people built storage cities for Pharaoh, namely Pitom and Ramses. But as much as they would set their hearts to afflict them, so did they multiply and so did they spread. The Egyptians were disgusted because of the children of Israel. The Egyptians enslaved the children of Israel with crushing labor. They embittered their lives with hard labor, with mortar and with bricks and with all kinds of labor in the fields. All their work that they made them to do was crushing labor, as we read in our Haggadot.
This is true, right? This is like past the matzah. This is getting, right? It's getting satiristic. Now, the next step, that's a new phrase. No, it's not. I just made that up. Okay, the next step of our narrative, the next piece of the narrative, is where Pharaoh sends out the decree to the Jewish midwives and says, if girls are born to the Jews, you can let them live. But if boys are born, then you have to put the boy child to death, the baby boy to death. And of course, the midwives defied Pharaoh's decree, and somehow they kept the boys alive. Then we read about in this context the birth of Moses. Again, amidst all this danger, amidst the decree of Pharaoh against the Jewish boys, we have, against that backdrop, we have the miraculous, if you will, the miraculous birth of Moshe and his survival and his rescue by the daughter of, ironically enough, Pharaoh's daughter herself, who rescues him from the Nile River, as we know, as he's floating there in his Moses basket. Then we have the Moses origin story. So that was the story about how slavery begins, and that will precipitate, that will set the stage for ultimately the Exodus. How does Moses come into the scene? So Moses is born, cast upon the Nile, rescued by Pharaoh's daughter, and then we have Moshe grows up. Moses grows up, page 351. And please read this. This is very important, and this will be the focus of tonight's class, on the stories pertaining to Moshe's coming of age. Chapter 2, verse 11, it was in those days.
It was in those days that Moshe grew up, and he went out to his brothers, and he saw their burdens. He saw an Egyptian man striking a Hebrew man, one of his brothers. He turned this way and that way, and he saw that no man was there. So he struck the Egyptian and hid him in the sand.
And by the way, hiding him in the sand is not like when you were a kid and you played on the beach and you kind of like played in the sand and you got buried in the sand, like kind of up to your neck, and then at some point you got out. When it says he hid him in the sand, right, he turned this way and that way, saw that no man was there, struck the Egyptian, hid him in the sand. He killed him. He killed him, and then he buried him in the sand. Okay, continue. That's story number one. Story number two.
He went out on the second day, and look, two Hebrew men were quarreling. He said to the wicked one, "Why would you strike your friend?" He replied, "Who made you a man, a prince, and a judge over us? Do you plan to slay me as you have slain the Egyptian?" Moshe became frightened and said, "Indeed, the matter has become known."
Okay, so hold on. See, here we have a very important second narrative. The first story is where he sees Egyptian on Jew violence, intervenes, rescues the Jew, kills the Egyptian, buries him. The next day, it says, the very next day, he sees two Jews fighting. This is Jew on Jew violence. And one is lifting his hand to strike the other. And he says, "Russia, wicked one, why are you striking your friend?" And what does he say? The fellow doesn't stop. He doesn't take a step back and become contrite and become remorseful and apologetic. He doesn't do any of that. What does he say?
"Who are you?"
"Who are you?" The ultimate answer, right? Don't look at, I don't care about what you said, right? It doesn't matter that you make a good point. Let me attack your character. "Who are you? Who made you a king? Who made you a prince? Who made you a judge over us? Are you going to kill me like you killed the Egyptian yesterday?" So Moses, what's his response?
Oops.
Okay, he becomes frightened. And he says, and I'll quote in the Hebrew, "Achein noda hadavar," which is translated as, "Indeed, the matter has become known." Stop for a second. What does that mean to you? Why is Moses afraid? And what is he saying? Why is he afraid?
Pharaoh will not
punished by the Egyptians.
For what?
Murder.
For murder, for killing the Egyptian. What does it mean? Indeed, the matter has become known. What matter?
That he killed the Egyptian. The body under the sand.
The body under the sand. In other words, the day before, he thought that he was going to get away with it. He thought there was only two people. Only one survived. Well, him. Right? There was an Egyptian taskmaster beating a Jewish fellow, beating him to the point that he would have died. Moses intervenes to save a life. Jewish law says if you see someone taking someone else's life, you're allowed to intervene and take out. It's called rodef, right? You're allowed to take out the murderer before they actually do the murder. So he takes out the Egyptian, looks this way and that, sees there's no one watching, buries him in the sand. He thinks that it's only him who knows about it and the man who he just saved. Now, there's no way that that man would go ahead and divulge the information and get him. Be like at the bar later that night, hey, do you know who saved me? Moses came in, Super Moses, he came in. He's awesome.
Well, he figured that they weren't going to tell the Egyptians.
Maybe you told me this. You know what you call a secret? Something that share one person at a time, right? That's what a secret is. Like, don't tell anybody, but here's some information. And that person says, don't tell anybody. Right? A secret is something that share one person at a time. The bottom line is, the word gets out, and by the next day, the Jewish assailant is telling Moses, who's trying to intervene, say, and he says, oh, what, you're going to kill me, kill the Egyptian? And he becomes afraid. Achein noida hadavar, indeed the matter has become known. Simple meaning is, what matter? The matter of the murder of the Egyptian yesterday, indeed has become known. In other words, now all the Jews know about it. It's a very short step from the Jewish community talking about it to Pharaoh finding out about it, and thus he becomes afraid. Why? He becomes afraid that he will be brought to justice. Indeed, the very next verse says, and one more verse, verse number 15.
Pharaoh heard of this incident, and he attempted to kill Moshe. Moshe fled from Pharaoh, and he settled in the land of Midian.
All right, that's it. So indeed, the next verse tells us that Pharaoh does hear of the incident. It does spread. It goes viral. And Pharaoh wants to kill Moshe, Moses, to the point that he has to run away. Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's what we're going to read right now. Open up your Torah studies text, please, to find out an alternative interpretation. And this is going to be a major focus of tonight's session. You can open up your booklets. Should be pretty much right there. First few pages, or first page, what is it?
Text 1A,
Moses' fear, yes. Text 1B. Let's skip straight to 1B. What?
You know, it's fascinating that Moses went out and then he saw his brother's burden.
Yes.
And then there was a putting of a body into a hole in the ground.
Yes.
And that seems to be a parallel to Yosef going out.
Interesting.
And seeing his brother's burden and saying, you know what, at some point, your burden's going to be so light, you're just going to be bowing down to me, I'll just make all your decisions, life will be great for all of us. And in both instances, the primary character here assumed brotherhood.
Right.
Assumed things would be okay and assumed he would not be killed.
And the brothers turn against them.
The brothers turn against him.
Very interesting.
In both instances.
I like that parallel. Nice. All right, Jillian, text 1B, here's Rashi explaining what does it mean that Moses is afraid and says, indeed, the matter has become known.
And Moses became frightened. To be explained to... I'm sorry, I can't read it.
No worries. Is it too small?
I don't have glasses and I can't read
it. It's okay.
Sure you do.
It's okay. You can pass. No worries. No worries. No pressure. Sorry. You ready?
And Moses became frightened. To be explained, according to its simple meaning, that Moses was afraid Paro would kill him.
So in other words, there's too many brackets here. The simple explanation, Rashi says, Kipshuta, the simple explanation is, he was afraid that Pharaoh would kill him, finding out the news. Continue, this is the key point.
Midrashically, it is interpreted to mean that he was worried because he saw in Israel wicked slanderers. It said, since this is so, perhaps they do not deserve to be redeemed.
Now we have a whole new interpretation. Moses becomes afraid and he says, indeed the matter has become known. What does it mean? Simple explanation is, Pharaoh knows about it, or it's known, Pharaoh's going to know about it, I'm afraid for my life. The deeper explanation is, Moses became frightened because he realized why the Jews were enslaved. Why were they worthy, in a negative sense? Why were they deserving to be exiled, to be enslaved by the Egyptians? Because of Lashon Hara, because of evil talk gossip. What was the evil talk and gossip? About him. He rescued a Jew. The next thing you know, you have another Jew saying, I know about you, and you're going to kill me like you killed that guy. In other words, it had already become the fodder of gossip. It had already undergone the gossip mill. And thus, Moses says, now I know why it is. Not maybe Pharaoh will know. He says, now I know why the Jewish people are deserving, God forbid, to be enslaved in Egypt. It's because of the sin of Lashon Hara, of evil talk, of gossip, of slander, negative talk, one person about someone else. That's a deeper explanation. That's the non-literal interpretation. It's a deeper interpretation. And again, that's why, so he's frightened. Moses is frightened because he says, now I know there's a real justification, a real good reason why they're enslaved. And he says, indeed, the matter has become known. It's known to me, the matter has become known, why it is that they are indeed punished like this. Which raises a few questions. It's a really nice, when I say nice, it's a very interesting and compelling interpretation. And yet, we have a few questions on this. Number one, the implication is that Lashon Hara, evil talk, slander, gossip, is a very terrible crime, according to this explanation. So terrible that it merits and it warrants the enslavement of the Jewish people. Question number one, is it really that bad?
Or at least it could keep them from being redeemed.
Or it can keep them from being redeemed. That is, why are they not yet redeemed? Because of this gossip and slander.
The Nuremberg trials convicted a man for this kind of propaganda against Jews and sentenced him to death.
Interesting. So your argument is, it is pretty serious. But again, looking at it from a general perspective, we might ask the question, is it really so terrible? Yes, Lashon Hara, speaking negatively about somebody or gossiping or peddling information is not good. Later on, the Torah prescribes us, tells us that we're not allowed to do this. The Talmud compares it to killing another, etc. But we can ask the question, is that really a cardinal sin? Right, that keeps the Jewish people enslaved in Egypt? Was that so bad? And the reason why I'm asking it that way is because we could ask another question. Isn't another sin that they were doing, isn't that other sin greater than this? What is the other sin that they were doing? They were, according to all accounts, they were serving idols. They were worshiping idols like the Egyptians. You know the song, Walk Like an Egyptian? Well, originally it was worship like an Egyptian, and it played in played in Goshen. It went viral on YouTube. Exactly, it was all the rage. In fact, text 2 points us in this direction. Mike, please read text 2, page 251.
When Israel left Egypt, the angel Samael stood to prosecute them and said before the Holy One, "Blessed be He, Master of the universe, until now these ones have served idols, and now you split the sea for them?"
In other words, these ones, the Jewish people, are idolaters. So why are you saving them and collapsing the sea on the others? What makes them any better? Before we get to God's answer, what does this tell us about the state of Jewry in Egypt? What were they doing? Were they monotheistic? They weren't strictly monotheistic, they were polytheistic. They had assimilated amongst their neighbors, and they had begun serving idols. Thus, we can ask the following question. What was so surprising to Moses? He becomes afraid. Now the matter is known. Now I know why. It's because of all this gossip. What, he didn't know they were serving idols? Isn't that a more grievous sin? Wasn't that a more... Idolatry is in the top 10. Not only that, it's one of the three averot, one of the three cardinal sins that one is supposed to give up their life for and not violate. It doesn't say that about Lashon Hara. If somebody comes to somebody, God forbid, and says, either gossip, tell me a juicy piece of information, or I'll kill you, you know what you do? You say, well, you know what I heard about... You make something up, right? You give them the juice. You give them the info. It doesn't say you give up your life. When it comes to idolatry, somebody says, kiss the cross or die. You say, I ain't doing it. I'm not going to bow down to the idol. I'm not going to worship something, a foreign deity. So what does it mean for us? It all leads to a question. What? Moses was unsure. Why is it that the Jewish people are enslaved? And now he has clarity. Because now his story has been gossiped about. He didn't think that the idolatrous practices was deserving enough. But now there's gossip. Oh, that's terrible. But the gossip did it. What about all the idolatry? Good question. I think it's a pretty decent question. And finally, one more question. Again, the premise of the Midrashic interpretation that Rashi cites is that why is Moses frightened? Because now it dawns on him why it is that the Jewish people are still enslaved and have not been redeemed. Why? Because of the sin of gossip. Was Moses really surprised? He really needed an answer? 400 years prior, God appeared to Abraham at the Bris Bein Absarim, at the covenant of the parts. And God said to Abraham, what? What did God say to Abraham? You should know. Yeah? Your children are going to be foreigners in a foreign land. And they're going to be enslaved. And their lives are not going to be easy. But afterwards, they're going to go out with great wealth and great fanfare, and it's going to be amazing. So the concept of slavery, why the Jewish people were enslaved, has a reason. We don't need to come up with a gossip reason. We don't need to come up with even an idolatry reason. The reason is simply God had foretold it. It was part of destiny. It had to happen. So the script was playing out. Again, the question is, Moses suddenly now has an epiphany. When the Jew says, you're going to kill the Egyptian, he has an epiphany, according to the second interpretation of Rashi. He says, now I know why they're so like this. Why they're enslaved. Because of gossip. Number one, what about idolatry? Number two, God had foretold it. These are the questions we might ask. So when you really dig deep into the Rashi, truly, the second interpretation of Rashi, what he calls the Midrashic interpretation, doesn't seem to hold water. Why would this suddenly be the epiphany? Why would this dawn on Moses that the Egyptian slavery is tied into gossip? That doesn't seem like the rationale for it. Make sense? Question makes sense? Okay.
Could it be that slave's answer was, is that, you know what, we learned this from the Egyptians, this is what they do to us, this is what we do to each other, and don't judge us for, and then he got scared because he became, they had descended to the level of brutality of the Egyptians.
What? Oh, like hitting each other?
How they, yeah.
Yeah, but that's, okay, fine, that could be true, but that's not what Rashi says about Achi Noidadavar. Rashi clearly says that why, according to the second interpretation, why was Moshe frightened? Because he said, because of the gossip, now I know why they're enslaved.
Well, could it be because he was afraid they would be unworthy and God would change his mind?
Not redeem them?
Yeah.
Okay, that's a good answer. You know, God had promised Abraham the slavery, but also the Exodus. Now maybe he was afraid the Exodus won't happen because of this, but because of what? Then we revert to the second question. Why is he concerned about the gossip and not the idolatry? The idolatry seems a bigger issue. Why would God save either A, gossipy people, or B, a people that deny him? I think B is a stronger question. In other words, if I gave you the two options...
Take it out to God.
Okay, idolatry seems to be a pretty big...
Well, to us,
To God also, the Torah says. It's the first two commandments. Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I'm the Lord your God. Second commandment. Don't have any other gods, right? It seems pretty big. Okay, listen. We're going to answer this, right? Because Rashi says it, so we're going to explain it. So, but I just want to build the question and set it up. Okay, so part two. That was all part one. Part one is background, Rashi's interpretation, and the questions on Rashi. Part two. Let's look at the process of Jewish nationhood. How and when did the Jewish people become a nation? And this is going to help explain why it is that the idolatry wasn't a big deal. Now, take this in context, right? Why? We have to explain two things. Why is gossip such a big deal? And why wasn't the idolatry the big deal? So now we're going to first explain why the idolatry wasn't such a deal breaker. If not for the gossip, that would have been fine, like you're alluding to. Why wasn't idolatry the deal breaker? To understand that, we need to look at how did the Jewish nation become a nation? When did they become a nation? So I'll open the question to all of you here tonight. When did the Jewish people become a nation? Give me the moment. Huh? Mount Sinai? Mount Sinai? Exodus? Mount Sinai? Mount Sinai?
I don't know the point.
Okay. Good. So the truth is...
They didn't either. They were just following
Moses. Yeah, they were like, yeah, we don't know.
Get us out of here.
Okay. According to most commentaries, the Jewish people become a nation with the Exodus. They don't get their national mandate until Sinai, which is really important. To become a nation, you need to know what you're doing as a nation, right? You need your charter, you need your constitution, you need your document of marching orders. So that comes at Sinai. But the general nationhood, peoplehood, happens with the Exodus. There's a beautiful language used in the book of Deuteronomy, text number 3, that describes what happened with the Exodus. Steve, please read 252.
Or has any God performed miracles to come and take him, a nation, from the midst of another nation, with trials, with signs, with wonders, and with war, and with a strong hand, and with an outstretched arm, and with great awesome deeds, as all that the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes?
This is all a really long rhetorical question that Moses is asking his people before he passed away. He says, has God done this, or has any God done this for any other nation, any other people, to extract them from the bowels, from the midst of another nation, and to do all of the wonderful things that God has done for you? Certainly then you should love God, appreciate God, follow God's ways, study Torah, do the mitzvot, etc. That's the context of text number 3. But let's focus on the one phrase, the dramatic phrase. Has any other God performed miracles to come and take him, a nation, from the midst of another nation? What does that mean, taking a nation from the midst of another nation? The implication is the Jewish people were a nation that were inside another nation. A nation inside a nation. So embedded were they inside their host nation that they didn't have their own discernible identity. You couldn't tell that they were their own nation. That's assimilation. Take a look at text number 4. Marnim, please read 4. The Midrash expounds on this. 252.
What is the meaning of a nation from the midst of another nation? It is analogous to someone who extracts a fetus from the innards of a beast. Thus did the Holy One, blessed be He, take Israel from Egypt, as it is stated, and the innards and the thighs.
Now, why are we quoting the innards and the thighs? That's a sacrificial a verse from Vayikra Leviticus about the sacrifices. And it talks about the innards. The innards of the animal are called kerev. Kerev, or innards. And the phrase in Deuteronomy, when it talks about God extracting one nation from the midst of another nation, the word midst in Hebrew is kerev, mi kerev, goy, mi kerev, goy. One nation, goy means nation, a nation from the kerev, the midst or the innards of another nation. The Midrash says it means innards. And I translated it as the bowels, extracting one nation from the midst, from the innards, from the kishkas, from the guts, from the innards of another nation. What's the analogy? Like a fetus in an animal. So on the one hand, it's its own thing, right? It's not the mother. It's a new life. It's its own self-contained life, so to speak. On the other hand, it's not yet discernible as its own, right? This is before sonograms, right? This is before we get right. It's part of the mother. It doesn't eat on its own. It doesn't breathe on its own. Well, it doesn't gain nutrition on its own. Everything, its entire life, its sustenance, its food, its oxygen, it's all dependent on the mother. So too, on some level, we can say. So too, we might say the following. We might say that the Jewish people, although there were the Jewish people, and the Egyptians, but they were so assimilated, they were so part of Egypt, that they didn't have their own discernible identity. So although it says God took a nation from a nation, before God took out our nation, we were part of that nation. Like a fetus that's part of the mother, doesn't really have its own identity until it's born, until it emerges into daylight, so to speak. The same thing is true of the Jewish people.
Taking it from the kishkas, like that's actually taking kishka from the children if you get there soon enough.
Exactly, right. You got to rescue it before it gets mixed in. And then once you rescue it, it has its own identity as the kishka. I like your example.
Very good. It's worth saving.
It's worth, exactly.
It's worth extracting, so it's like the Jewish people.
Exactly. Now, so what we see here is, again, that the Jewish people, whilst still in Egypt, before the Exodus, right? On the one hand, they were somewhat distinct, but they were not distinct enough that they had their own identity. They were part of the identity of the Egyptians. In other words, on a very basic level, like we said before, they were also serving idols, just like their host nation, the Egyptians. So that when God took the Jews out, he was rescuing one nation that looked like the other. He pulled out one from the other. It looked like it was a big mix. Pulled it out nonetheless, and then they became their own discernible, distinct nation. Why again? Because they were also serving idols. The question now is, were they always serving idols in Egypt? What happened? Jacob comes down with his family. Are they serving idols?
No.
No. So what happens? They had a yeshiva, right? They were studying Torah. What happens? Take a look at text 5a and text 5b. Marnie, you read, right?
I did.
Okay. Dan, please read 5a, 253.
But was there Torah in those days?
There was. There was some sort of preliminary version or whatever, some sort of version of Torah that they could study. They had it by prophecy. They had some sort of divination of Torah that they studied. What happened at Sinai was they became officially mandated to follow it, as opposed to something that people would study on their own. They became officially obligated into that way of being.
It was an option before.
Exactly. Exactly. It was an option of some wisdom that had somehow come down, whatever. 5a.
Our forefather Jacob taught all of his sons, and he appointed Levi as a leader. And Levi remained in the house of study to teach the way of God and to keep the commandments of Abraham. And Jacob commanded his children to not become distant from the children of Levi, lest they forget the teachings. The matter became stronger among the children of Jacob and those who were attracted to them, and there emerged in the world a nation that knew God.
So Maimonides, Rambam, is emphasizing that as the Jews come into Egypt, they are their own nation. There emerged in the world a nation that knew God. They studied Torah. They knew God. They were monotheistic. So what happened? 210 years later, they're non-discern. You can't discern the distinction between them and the Egyptians. What happened? Text 5b, Rambam continues. I'll read this. When the Jews extended their stay in Egypt, however, they relapsed and learned from the Egyptians to worship the stars as they did, with the exception of the tribe of Levi, who clung to the mitzvot of the patriarchs. The tribe of Levi never served false gods. 11 out of 12 tribes went and followed the Egyptian ways. It was only the tribe of Levi, who were the teachers of the people, who remained locked in and consistent and true to form and true to God. Within a short time, Maimonides continues, the fundamental principle that Abraham had planted would have been uprooted, and the descendants of Jacob would have returned to the errors of the world and their crookedness. Because of God's love for us and to uphold the oath he made to Abraham, our patriarch, he brought forth Moses, our teacher, the master of all prophets, and sent him to redeem the Jews. After Moses, our teacher, prophesied and God chose Israel as his inheritance, he crowned them with mitzvot and informed them of the path to serve him, teaching them the judgment prescribed for idol worshippers and all those who stray after it. So what happens here is Moses gives us a monotheistic timeline. Abraham discovers monotheism, teaches it to Isaac, teaches it to Jacob. Jacob teaches it to his sons. And at that point, they all know monotheism and they're all serving, worshiping one God. And all is good. And the tribe of Levi, they're the ones that keep the people in check and teach the people. But then after centuries in Egypt, he says, well, even before the centuries elapsed, he says, when the Jews extended their stay in Egypt, in other words, they spent enough time in Egypt that most of the tribes forgot their path and their truth and their teaching and their Jewishness, if you will, and they became idol worshippers to the point that God committed to Abraham that he would redeem them, that he would redeem Abraham's descendants, so he sends Moses to redeem. He chooses them, he redeems them, and then he gives them Torah and mitzvot and brings them back to the path of monotheism. That is the arc of Jewish nationhood. They begin monotheistic, they start off monotheistic, they stray in Egypt, they're chosen by God, and they come back. Here's the big question. The big question is, were they monotheistic before God rescues them or not? Before God sends Moses, are they monotheistic or are they still polytheistic? Are they still serving idols? At the time that God meets Moses at the burning bush, are they still serving idols or had they come back? Still serving idols. So that now the question is, why did God redeem them? Maimonides says, because God promised Abraham. But still, what was the redeeming factor, no pun intended, or whatever. Literally, what was the redeeming factor for the Jewish people? They were still steeped in idolatry. What's going on here?
Still a covenant,
good. The way the Rebbe explains this is by focusing on the words that Maimonides chooses in that text that we just read. Look what Maimonides said. He says, second. Look at this. After Moses, our teacher, prophesied, and God chose Israel as his inheritance. God chose Israel. In other words, why did God rescue and redeem the Jewish people from Egypt? It's not because of their virtue. It's not because they had so many mitzvot under their belt. It's not because they were monotheistic. That's not why. It's because simply God chose the Jewish people at that time. God promised Abraham centuries earlier, but at that point in time, Maimonides emphasizes that God chose the Jewish people. We have to understand what is choice. If I offer you, okay, name one food that you like and one food that you don't like.
Avocados I like.
Avocados you like. What food don't you like?
Beets.
Beets. Okay, so we're mixing two people together.
Beets.
You like beets? Okay. I like both, but there are things that I don't like. Like mushrooms, I don't care for.
Oh, I love mushrooms. Now,
see that? We're all different. Let's talk about that. Let's just use this example. We'll merge you both together. And we have avocados we like and beets we don't like. Let's say that that's... And let's say I offer you a choice. Let's say it's one person who likes avocados, does not like beets. And I say, here's your choice for dinner. You can have the avocado special or the beet special. What are you going to choose? The avocado special. Why? Because you like avocados and you don't like beets. Was that a choice?
No.
On the one hand, you can say it's a choice. Of course, there were two options, two plates in front of me, and I chose what I like and I didn't choose what I don't like. On the other hand, is it really a choice? Did you choose, or is it not even an option? It's not even a valid option. In other words, if there's something compelling about the thing that you're choosing, then that makes, that creates a scenario where it chose itself and you didn't even choose it.
Turkey wontons.
Turkey wontons are good or no good?
Good.
Good. Turkey wontons. That's a very exotic and very specific dish.
I wonder why nobody had mentioned turkey wontons until now.
See that? Like what's, we got kishke, turkey wontons, avocado, and beets. Tonight, we're going to make, this is true. We're going to put it all together. It's a shmorik. Okay. So again, this is a very interesting point, a compelling point that's brought in Jewish literature, philosophical literature, mystical literature, the teachings of the Rebbe in many places, that true choice means that there's no feature about one versus the other that is compelling. Because the moment one is more compelling than the other, what kind of choice is that? It's not even a choice. Of course you're going to choose it. What kind of choice is there? Yeah.
Like between a Cadillac and a broken down Studebaker. What are you going to choose?
Exactly. Right. Am I going to choose the jalopy or the nice car? Obviously the nice car. That's not a choice. What kind of choice is that? You know what real choice is? True choice is when you have two identical things. And there's no feature in one over the other. There's nothing more compelling about this one versus that one. The example that I was taught when I first was introduced to this concept, when I was studying this for the first time, was imagine you have two apples in front of you. Not an avocado and a beet, not a turkey wonton and some kishke, not a Cadillac and a jalopy, no. Two identical apples, red, delicious apples. They're exact size, exact shape, exact color, exact ripeness, exact sweetness, exact texture. Everything, the stem curves at the exact angle, identically one to the other. And now you have a true choice. Which one will you choose? The apple on the right or the apple on the left?
The apple on the left.
Obviously, right?
I'm left-handed.
Oh, well, that's again somewhat of a compelled choice. But imagine.
Stack them up
or whatever it is, right? And there's nothing compelling about one versus the other. There's no feature in one that says, choose me over the other. It's absolutely identical. It's only then, precisely then, that you can really use the word choice. Because now you have to make a choice. Otherwise, the choice was already made. Now you're making a choice. When we say, Ata vechartanu mikol ha'amim, you, God, chose us from the other nations. Or you chose us from the Egyptians. When can you say that?
When they were the same.
When can God truly choose the Jewish people? When they're serving idols. Are you with me? If they were monotheistic, and the Egyptians were polytheistic, if the Jews were serving God, and the Egyptians were serving idols, what kind of choice is that? Obviously the Jews should be saved and put on a pedestal by Mount Sinai, given the Torah. Obviously, look at the Jewish people. They're so much more virtuous. When do you have a true choice? When can it be said that God is truly choosing the Jewish people? It's when there's no distinctive feature or factor between the two. Or amongst the two. These are idol worshippers and those are idol worshippers. And still, like the verse in Deuteronomy we had before, still God rescued and extracted one nation from the bowels of an identical nation. Why? That's what God chose. The power of choice is when you have two identical things and still you choose one over the other. Let's see this inside. In the Rebbe's words, text number 9, 256. We're skipping a few pages. Don't worry. I summarized all the stuff in between.
It is known that the true definition of choice occurs only when the choosing is decided by the chooser and not on account of any merit that the object possesses. When one desires an object due to a certain desirable merit it presents, we cannot call that free choice, inasmuch as the determining factor does not stem from the chooser, rather it flows from the object being chosen.
So here we have the Rebbe explaining what is the definition, true definition of free choice. Free choice means that you are the one that is choosing and it's not choosing itself. Or it's not compelling you to choose it, you're choosing it. And thus, the two items need to be similar and identical in order for there to be a true, to truly constitute the idea of choice. And so, as they stood in Egypt, as they existed as a nation inside another nation, they were identical. Notwithstanding the fact that that standing before them was Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and promises, etc. At that moment, they were identical. And at that moment, you can call it a choice. History be forgotten for a moment. At the present, they were the same. And so now we understand why Moses is not perturbed by the idolatry. Why Moses never became frightened. And he never said, now I know, now the matter is known why the Jews are enslaved. He never said that about idolatry. You know why? Because idolatry is not a deal breaker. Idolatry is an equalizer, and that's fine. Because all it's doing is equalizing the Jewish people then, at that moment, and the Egyptians at that moment, setting the stage for God's choice. Moses was confident that notwithstanding the equivalency between the worship equivalency between the Jews and the Egyptians, both worshiping false idols, God would still choose the Jewish people. Idolatry didn't get him concerned. Are you with me? I've answered the question why it is that Moses never became frightened and never said, the matter is indeed known when it came to idolatry. Because idolatry was not a deal breaker. What was a deal breaker? It was gossip. Why was gossip a deal breaker and idolatry not? Moses was confident that even if the Jews looked like the Egyptians, God would still choose the Jewish people. Moses was confident of that. He had no fear that that would happen. When did he become afraid? He became afraid when he saw that the Jewish nation wasn't a nation. He was confident that God would choose the Jewish nation and pull them out from the Egyptian nation. But what was his fear? His fear was the Jewish people were not a nation altogether. Because what is a nation? What is a people? What is an am?
Something distinct.
Also, people that are
together
and unified. And what does Moses see? He sees that even though he saved a fellow Jew from an Egyptian taskmaster that was beating him to the point of his death, the next day, what is happening? One Jew is beating another Jew. And when he intervenes, that Jew says, "Who are you?" Or "Who are Jew?" Right? Who died and made you king? Right? Who? Why do you think you're any better than me? You're calling me Russia. You're calling me wicked. Who are you? You killed someone yesterday. You're going to do it to me also. He saw that the people are fragmented. He saw that the people are disunified. There's disunity amongst the people. Can you call this a nation? This is a diverse, not even a collection. This is a fragmented bunch of people, of individuals. This is not a nation. It's a random bunch of people that turn against each other. And that's what broke his heart. If we were a nation, even serving idols, Moses knew that God would choose us. That's what choice is. I choose this over this. Why? They're identical. I still choose this. But choice of a nation over another nation, or to pull one nation out of another nation, implies that that being chosen is a cohesive unit called nation, called an am. When he saw the Jews fighting against each other and then turning against him, he said, he became afraid. Now I'm afraid. How can God rescue the Jewish nation if they don't behave like a nation? Forget the idolatry. They're not one unit to save. Well, God's going to save that one person, Yankel and not Shmerel? And Beryl and not Chaim? I was about to be out of Jewish names, which is very shocking after three. Very surprising there on my part. Anyway, right? Who's God going to save?
Menachem Mendel seemed very common.
That seems like a very common name for all time. Right? So who would God save? How would God save them all together if they don't consider themselves together? How could God rescue the people if they're not a people? They're individuals that turn against each other. Text 10a. Again, Anne, please read this. Text 10a, page 257, in the Rebbe's words.
There must be a Hefsa, a nation in which God's choice can take effect.
Right. God will choose the Jewish people, he had no doubt. But God has to choose a something. There's no something. There's no entity to choose. Again, an entity, the entity here would be a nation, a national entity. There was no national entity. There was no national identity. There was no nation. There were a bunch of people that turned against each other. So who's there to save? Who's there to choose? Who's there to extract? So one second. Oh, text 10b. Let's do one more. Text 10b. Jillian, please read text 10b. Oh, sorry again. Sorry. Sarah, 10b. Yeah.
Speaking ill of others occurs, even if there's no malicious intent, even if there's no desire to speak ill, and there are no words of hatred. Rather, the essential act of speaking negatively about another reveals and emphasizes the disunity and disparity between one and his fellow.
I didn't mean ill, I didn't mean bad, but I gossiped about someone. It means I don't empathize with them. I don't feel...
I don't identify with them.
That's why I can be so callous and insensitive toward them. I didn't mean it. It wasn't intentional. It doesn't matter. The fact that you can say something like that means that you don't feel connected. You don't identify with them. You don't feel unified with them. And thus, there is no nation. So as the Rebbe points out, this is Moses' fear. This is his concern. He says, Achein noida hadavar vayir ma'id. He becomes very afraid and he says, now I know. Now I'm afraid that redemption is not going to happen because there's nothing for God to redeem. Right? It's like, I'm trying to think of a good example. It's like you're trying to pull out something and the thing collapses, it breaks apart in your hand. You end up with, it goes all between your fingers. There's nothing to collect for God. There's nothing to pull out. It's disintegrated. Instead of one mass, one unit that God can pull out, albeit idolatrous, it's fine. You can choose one apple, even though it looks like the other apple. God can choose, and God does choose and will choose, and Moses was confident that he would choose the Jewish people from the Egyptians, but they have to be a people. They have to be a unified mass. And they weren't. They weren't a single unit. So what's the antidote? Look around today. I wanted to do this very specifically at the end of the class to really bring home the message, but I think it's worth mentioning right now. You look around today, and we ask ourselves the question, are there Jewish people unified?
No.
Are we unified? Are we one nation?
No.
Right. Forget, is the world, is all of humanity on the same page? That we know. Huh?
Don't even want to be.
Well, that's part of the problem, right? Right? Forget all people. The Jewish people are a minority of a minority of a minority. And we still can't get along. Right? Unfortunately. We're still not perfect in getting along. Let's not speak so negatively. Right? There's still a long way to go. I think we can relate very, very powerfully with this. We ask for Mashiach, we ask for redemption, we want God to take us, to bring us back, to build a Beis HaMikdash, and God will. The question is, are we a nation? Are we together? So what is it in our lifetimes, in our experiences, in our experience, what is it that brings us together even when we're separate? What's the thing that brings us most together? Tragedy and loss and pain and anti-Semitism, right? All the negative stuff, right? Somebody, huh?
And a good meal.
Well, a good meal, definitely. But in a negative way, oftentimes, it's when there's the negative stuff, right? God forbid the shooting in Pittsburgh, and suddenly like everyone comes to shul, and everyone gets together, and everyone's on Facebook liking each other, and everyone's profile pictures are similar, and huh? Yeah, we're in Jeff's place now, so a tragedy happened in our community, we come together. So the negative, the challenges and the pressures and the tragedies bring us together. What's fascinating in the account of the story of Exodus, and we don't really have time to go into each and every verse, but here's what you need to know. Chapter 1 of Exodus sets the stage by talking about the origins of slavery. Chapter 2 talks about the birth of Moses. The last verse, the last few verses of chapter 2. Okay? After Moses says, "Now I know what's wrong. There's no nation that's unified." After that, it says, after many days, 253 in the Chumash, after many days had passed, the king of Egypt died. The children of Israel groaned from the hard work, and they cried out. Their cries caused by the hard work went up to God. God heard their cry, God remembered his covenant, etc. God saw the children of Israel, and God knew he took their cries to heart. What happens? The slavery becomes harder. And what happens then? They cry out to God. And they cry out as one. The implication here is they cry out in unison. They are now together. What has brought them together? Unfortunately, tragedy, oppression, slavery, hardship. That's what brought them together. But together they were brought. It's a negative form of unity, but that's what brought out the unity then for them. And immediately what happens right after that is God speaks to Moses at the burning bush. And you know what God says? To Moses, God says, "Ra'oi ra'isi es ani ami asher b'Mitzrayim. I have seen the suffering of my nation, which is in Egypt, and I've heard its cries, not their cries, its cries in the singular." In other words, God is saying, they are now one, and they are now worthy of redemption. Moses saw the disunity, and that troubled him and frightened him greatly. The antidote to disunity was unity. In the narrative of Egypt, of the exit of the slavery and the Exodus of our Torah portion, what is it specifically that brought out the unity? The oppression, the hardship. It got worse, and so they banded together. While it was bad, but it wasn't really, really bad, and who am I to say it wasn't really bad? But it wasn't as bad as it got. The pressure went up, they started fighting against each other. It went up even harder, even worse, and now they had nothing to do but band together. And now they banded together, God says, now it's time. And so, in this regard, we can finally read the explanation of the Rebbe on this verse, what we started with, when Moses says, "Now I know, indeed the matter has become known." Text number 12. I think, Mike, we're up to you. Text 12. Page 259.
"And he said, 'Indeed, the matter has become known, that they deserve backbreaking labor.' What Moses meant was not that they deserve it as punishment for the sin of slander, but rather that they are deserving to be pressed with backbreaking labor. Hard labor that causes the body to thrash and become broken as a means to render them worthy of redemption. As we have previously mentioned, by means of breaking their spirit and casting down their pride, the cause of exile. Automatically, the disunity, the result, is nullified, namely, slander and evil gossip, and they are thus worthy of redemption."
And so, let me just paraphrase that. The Rebbe is saying, Bekitzer, in short and succinctly, what the Rebbe is saying is the following. What Moses said, he became frightened and said, "Indeed, the matter has been known." What was he saying? I know now why God is enslaving them and why God, in a sense, and it's hard to say this, but this is what the Rebbe says, why God has to make it even worse. Why? Because it still hasn't brought them together. But I know, says Moses, now I know that with increased hardship, the people will come together. And the moment they come together, then they'll become worthy to merit God's redemption. Let's focus now. So now we have, hopefully, clarity on a deeper level to the story. Moses witnesses the disunity amongst the people. He says, this is not good. This constitutes and renders the Jewish people unworthy of God's redemption because they're not a nation to redeem. You have to have a nation to redeem. They're not even a nation. Moses knows that with increased hardship, it will break down the disunity amongst the people and elicit and bring out the unity. And that's his comfort, and indeed that happens shortly thereafter. Let's talk about us, draw some lessons, and close out this class. For us, again, we can look around today and we notice that the unity, our unity, Jewish unity, is not as strong as it could be. Not as strong as it should be. Far cry from where it needs to be. We also notice that when things get difficult, we band together. When things get difficult, God forbid there's a swastika in a community center, we all show up. We all feel together. It doesn't matter which show, right? Tragedy in Pittsburgh, it doesn't matter which denomination it was, we all feel it. We all feel it in Pittsburgh, we all feel it around the U.S. and around the world. Jews rallies around the world because of what happened in one place. Who is like the Jewish people, one nation on earth? Something happens in one corner, one neighborhood of the earth, and everyone, all Jews come out. Every community has a rally. It's an incredible thing. The message here tonight is that it's unity that is our strength and our redeeming quality, quite literally. We should not wait. That's point number one. Point number two is we should not wait, God forbid, for the hardships and the tragedies to bring us together. You and I have the ability to get along with someone, to repair our relationships, to be friendlier to someone else, to a stranger, to a neighbor, to a loved one, to go out of our way, to empathize, to feel for, to be connected with another person, a fellow Jew, even without, God forbid, the hardship. Tonight's lesson is that it's in our best interest to be one. One nation, united. United, we stand. Divided, we fall. It's within our, we have the ability to choose that unity. We don't need to wait for the negative stuff to happen. We can propel it in a positive fashion. And please God, through our efforts to come together as a people, we should merit all of the blessings that we need individually and collectively, and experience redemption from any personal things that challenge us, and a collective redemption of our entire people and the entire world, in a world where there will be no more suffering, no more pain, no more oppression, and only light, goodness, and everlasting life. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Torah Studies.